B. Collins. Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Thursday, March 30th, 2017. Some activists are crowdfunding to raise money to pay back members of Congress who authorized a relaxation of internet privacy law. Nice going. This is my daily news and comment podcast, distributed free every day on YouTube and all my other outlets. And a quick programming note, tomorrow we'll return to our regular time for the Facebook Live feed. That'll be video on Facebook, 2 o'clock Pacific time, 5 o'clock Eastern. And I hope you'll tune in. And yes, we'll open up the phone lines and take your call so you can talk about the news. So shortly after I recorded and posted yesterday's podcast, I was checking email, and Carl Howard in Columbus, Ohio, and John Zweibel in Hawaii, both were tipping me to this exciting maneuver. Yesterday, I spent some time talking about the Resolution 34 that was passed last week by the Senate, this week by the House. It adopts the looser privacy standards of the Federal Trade Commission as compared with those of the Federal Communications Commission. And, in effect, it allows the phone companies and other internet service providers to collect the information from your browsing history. Everything that you have searched, every website you have visited. And that information, except the sensitive parts, and they don't explain which is actually sensitive. The definition of sensitive varies. That information can be sold and used to deliver ads to you. It's just another profit center that the ISPs want, and they think that greedy operators like Facebook and Google shouldn't be allowed to have and mine that information without competition. So what Zweibel and Howard tipped me off to is that there's at least one, and according to a poster here, multiple crowdfunding campaigns working along the same lines. They are raising money so that they can buy browsing history data on the members of Congress who voted for this shitty legislation. Now, I think this is a beautiful payback plan. And just to underscore, they say we will not share information that will impact the safety and security of their families, like a personal address. We will not dox people in the language of the web. However, all other details are fair game. It says so right in the resolution they voted to approve. And will an arch-conservative, evangelical Republican member of Congress be outed as somebody who had an account at Ashley Madison, the cheater's website where there were 30 million males and maybe only a handful of women? Or will we discover wide use of Pornhub by members of Congress, maybe even on their official computers? I don't know. But this could get very interesting. What is good for the goose? Meanwhile, the battle over an investigation into the Trump-Russia issues continues in Washington. We touched on this a bit yesterday as the leaders of the Senate Intelligence Committee held a press affair where they tried to play grown-up to the juvenile operations of Devin Nunes and the House Intelligence Committee. They're saying, trust us. We're going to get to the bottom of this. Richard Burr, who, of course, was an out-Trump supporter. Back in January, he was publicly making statements defending the Trump administration from some of the criticisms and allegations that had surfaced at that point. As I've said before, Richard Burr is as compromised as Devin Nunes. And Burr has more baggage, like the way he suppressed the Senate Intelligence Committee's torture report that was compiled under the direction of California Senator Feinstein. So I remain skeptical that the institutions inside the legislative branch can really bring sunlight and straighten out the confusion, the disinformation, the charges that are based on anonymous leaks back and forth, and truly get to the bottom of this. and I simply don't believe that it's going to happen with either one of those committees. And I don't trust the idea of a special commission like the 9/11 Commission. We've discussed that before. So I think that a truly independent special prosecutor is the only way forward. And we've got to get these political egos to get out of the way and accept that they have soiled themselves. But Mark Warner is really no better than some of the others. He's the ranking Democrat on the Senate Intel Committee. In the presser yesterday, he drew attention to reports that as many as 1,000 internet trolls in Russia were generating fake news stories and targeting them at swing states like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. And this is a reckless charge without any evidence, because we know that it's possible to mask your internet address, your IP address. It's easy to fake it, pretend you're in China when you're in Indiana. And he really is just watching Rachel Maddow and quoting her story from last week about the bots. And all of this, of course, never acknowledges the domestic disinformation campaigns that were active from both parties in the presidential race, and in particular, the scurrilous work of the Clinton campaign, David Brock's Correct the Record Dark Money Super PAC. No, Russia, 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 Russia. And I'm open to anything that can be proved about Russia, 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 Russia. But we haven't seen it. Last night on Facebook, I was part of an exchange of people who have just concluded that Russia manipulated our election. And one woman said, "Peter, what more do you need?" And I responded with one word: evidence. Two people I deeply respect, Bill Binney, former NSA technical director, and Ray McGovern, who was a CIA analyst for more than 27 years, they co-authored a column published yesterday at consortiumnews.com. Actually, it was on Monday. And it recaps the recent events regarding Chairman Nunes and the disclosures that he has made based on seeing classified information in an unscheduled and slightly bizarre visit to the White House complex. And Binney and McGovern say that this news presents Trump with an unwelcome but unavoidable choice: confront those who have kept him in the dark about such rogue activities, or live fearfully in their shadow. And in parentheses, they note the latter, living fearfully in the shadow, was the path chosen by Obama. Will Trump choose the road less traveled? So they go on to say his choice may decide whether there is a future for this constitutional republic. Either he can acquiesce to or fight against a deep state of intelligence officials who have a myriad of ways to spy on politicians and other citizens and thus amass derogatory material that can be easily transformed into blackmail. And McGovern and Binney cite the disclosures of Russell Tice, and he made those disclosures to me and to Sybil Edmonds in podcasts going back to 2013. And what Russ Tice warned us about is that everybody's communications are surveilled. And the authors here note that wiretapping is an old term. It's now interception of communications. And we know that all our metadata is captured. We suspect that all our phone calls are all recorded. And they can dig those up with a couple of keystrokes whenever they decide that you're a suspect. And we know from Russ Tice that key leaders of the government, a Senator Obama, a Senator Feinstein, a Judge Alito, a Judge Roberts, those were people who he witnessed the orders to wiretap, to surveil. Got to keep my own language scrubbed here. And so this is, I think, an important warning. I've linked to the article by Binney and McGovern in the show file for today's podcast. And what's interesting is toward the end of the piece, they actually have a little praise for Devin Nunes, who has shown what they say some spine in the face of the establishment's desires. And they note that Ray McGovern attended a ceremony at Devin Nunes' office in California a couple of years ago, where he honored a man who had been shunned by our government, a man named Terry Halberdier, who was a hero in the Israeli attack back in 1967 on the USS Liberty. Now, I'm not quite persuaded. I've never met Devin Nunes, as Ray McGovern has. But my take on the man is that he is a political tool, and that he only steps out of line when it's good for him or when he has no choice. Interesting article from Reuters, published a day or two ago, and it's focused on the Vault 7 leak that came out of WikiLeaks recently. These are hacking exploits, software, that have been used by the CIA. And we learned in the process that these materials were hacked several months ago, and then somebody recently brought them to WikiLeaks. And in the interim period, the CIA did not disclose to American companies the first day exploits. They're called day one exploits. And what that means is new software is put out and the spooks find vulnerabilities in it. And instead of notifying a company like Cisco, hey, that router has this vulnerability, they exploit this software glitch or opening, and they don't tell the companies. Now, what is buried in this article that stunned me are estimates that our government spends 90% of its cybersecurity budget on offensive cyber warfare. Now, I knew it was a significant amount, and it has been increased in recent years, but 90%? That is stunning. And, of course, our media never covers the 90% offensive exploits of our intelligence operatives. We act as if we're just occasionally victims. And, of course, that Russia was not counterattacking us in these allegations that it hacked into and tried to manipulate our elections. So that 90% figure is amazing. Trump's budget proposal would add about $1.5 billion in cybersecurity defense at Homeland Security. But according to this Reuters piece, the secret part of the U.S. intelligence budget alone totaled about $50 billion in 2013. And at that time, 8% went toward enhanced cybersecurity, while 72% was dedicated to collecting strategic intelligence and fighting violent extremism. The 90% figure has been confirmed by former NSA Deputy Director Rick Ledgett. And that's news to me. The Donald, going rogue with his Twitter machine again. And this one is delicious, because he is trying to widen the rift in the Republican Party. That's all I can figure here. Because he sent out a tweet attacking the Freedom Caucus because they wouldn't support his Obamacare repeal and replace bill last week. The tweet reads, "The Freedom Caucus will hurt the entire Republican agenda if they don't get on the team and fast. We must fight them in Dems in 2018. Now, this is a very unusual move. Trump is trying to enforce some party discipline by threatening to challenge these extreme right-wingers who mostly come from highly gerrymandered districts with an opponent in their next election. Now, I'm sure Trump the bully figures that this is really powerful, going to be really effective. But he desperately needs these people. And as he tries to raid Obamacare to pay for massive tax cuts for corporations and the rich, will the Freedom Caucus be there for him? I just think this is fascinating. And it's produced blowback from the members of the Freedom Caucus, some of whom I support when it comes to domestic surveillance. Tom Massey, a Kentucky Republican, is against surveillance. He's been very good on that issue. But he hit back at Trump, "It's a swamp, not a hot tub. We both came here to drain it." Sad. And Justin Amash of Michigan, again, a Freedom Caucus member, solid on the Fourth Amendment, pretty bad on almost everything else. his tweet, "It didn't take long for the swamp to drain Donald Trump. No shame, Mr. President. Almost everyone succumbs to the D.C. establishment." So this internal warfare in the Republican Party is delicious. And if you know any way that I can help them foster this and go deeper and longer, y'all just let me know, will you? The Trump plan to address NAFTA has been leaked. A draft letter to Congress has laid out his current positions, and they are much softer than what he articulated during the campaign when he called NAFTA the worst trade deal ever signed by the United States. He wants to seek some new provisions in the trade pact with Canada and Mexico that would allow the U.S. to reinstate tariffs if a flood of imports threatened to harm a domestic industry. Now, this is hardly the sweeping reform or the total repeal or rejection of NAFTA that Trump talked about during the campaign. Maybe that was just a negotiating stance. Yeah, probably. Anyway, it's interesting to see because I don't support NAFTA. I didn't at the time. And I would welcome some sort of renegotiation of it. But it appears that they are simply going to do some window dressing here with the threat of potential tariffs if certain standards aren't met. But the draft letter doesn't outline what the standards are. For example, whether a certain number in the trade deficit with Mexico, for example, would trigger these tariffs. So it's still pretty murky. But it's clear that Trump is dialing back his threats to reform NAFTA. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Benny Alto in Oregon, Andy Krieger, Brian Massey, and Joe Clarici. Every month they kick in $5 or $10. You can do it too, provided that you have the wherewithal. I don't want your cookie money, your cookie jar money. But come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. Takes you to the sign-up page where you've got choices. And we've got bonus books for new annual subscribers who give us a mailing address in the continental U.S. Well, the New York Times today, it does a kind of overview of the situation in the Middle East in the first, 60 or so days of the Trump administration. The U.S. has launched more airstrikes in Yemen this month than during all of last year. In Syria, the U.S. airlifted local forces to frontline positions and has been accused of killing civilians in airstrikes. In Iraq, American troops and aircraft are central in supporting an urban offensive in Mosul, where airstrikes killed scores of people on March 17th. 2 months after the inauguration of Trump, indications are mounting that the military of the United States is deepening its involvement in a string of complex wars in the Middle East that lack clear end games. Yeah. So what do we do in Yemen when we join our Saudi allies in announcing that we've killed enough people to declare victory? What happens in Syria? And these are big questions, and it appears that Trump gives them nary a thought. Now, I was sharply critical of many of the policies in this same region that were in the portfolio of Barack Obama. But he was never casual about ordering people killed. He had a process. Sometimes the military was pissed because he would drag out decision-making for days or months after they said, hey, we need to make a quick strike right here. And so the change is in a kind of reflexive approval that Trump offers, without giving much thought, it appears, to the impact and consequences. And the Saudis have been bombing Yemen for 2 straight years. Trump has agreed to resupply them with precision-guided munitions so that when those bombs drop and there's one that's a dud, people will be able to point at it and say, yep, was dropped by the Saudis, made in the USA. And so far this month, the U.S. has launched 49 strikes across Yemen, more than the full record of 2016. And that attack in Mosul on March 17th, where the final death toll could reach 200 or more, we're now told by the Pentagon there will be a formal investigation. And I've held back commenting on this because it is a little murky. News accounts show that the U.S. responded to a request from Iraqi forces on the ground to conduct those airstrikes, and survivors on the ground in Mosul tell reporters that advancing Iraqi soldiers, the ones who called in the airstrikes, knew that there were civilians huddled in the lower floors and the basements of buildings where we're told there were ISIS fighters on the roof who were the targets of the aerial attacks. And so I hope the investigation does get to the bottom of it, but one possible scenario is that it was Iraqis who called in the strike, perhaps for the wrong reasons, settling a score or who knows. But we continue to bear responsibility for the raids that are conducted and the civilians who are killed. In North Carolina, half a loaf regarding transgender bathroom regulation. The North Carolina Senate voted in favor of a bill today that repeals SB2, the controversial bathroom regulation bill that was signed into law, about 2 years ago under the preceding Republican governor. But it's a stinky compromise because it does not restore protections in the law for LGBTQ persons. Those were in place, particularly in Charlotte, when all of this right-wing hysteria began. And I have to say that, like the bans on same-sex marriage that Karl Rove engineered as a wedge issue to get evangelicals to the Republican polls back in 2004, many progressives who I know, particularly some who call themselves feminists, take the position that these bathroom laws are reasonable and that we must protect the privacy of women because a male at birth who identifies as a woman might try to use the bathroom or shower populated by females, and that this creates some sort of a creepy potential rape or other criminal behavior situation. And I really think that these threats are seriously exaggerated. There might be one or two cases a year where a predator pretends to be transgender in order to get voyeuristic or other kicks in a women's bathroom. But the vast majority of people, including transgender persons, don't go to the bathroom to flirt or to have sex or to force themselves on someone sexually. And consider this, all right? If I was a biological male who now identifies as female and I need to take a leak and I go into the ladies' room, am I going to commit a heterosexual sex offense of some sort? I don't see the problem here. And I don't see the need for any kind of federal regulation. I have good news from Washington, and it's rare to be able to say that. Senator Ron Wyden and Representative Earl Blumenthal, they're both Democrats from Oregon, have finally introduced a package of bills for sensible reform of the nation's ridiculous laws regarding marijuana. And as I've said many times, President Obama should have rescheduled marijuana under the Drug Enforcement Act before he left office. All it would take would be a stroke of that pen. But he didn't do it. And in the uphill battle that they'll face in Republican-controlled houses with idiots like Jeff Sessions promoting fear of marijuana legalization. Nevertheless, this is a very impressive package, which I think is quite comprehensive. The bills deal with the tax issues related to the marijuana industry. Medical weed here in California can be sold, but the people who sell it can't put that money in the bank. They have to leave it in cash. They have to use Brinks trucks to pay their tax bills at the local and state level. It is incoherent and unacceptable. And in a state that's been, where weed's been legal for adult use now for over a year, like Colorado, this creates a new incentive for crime. We legalized marijuana to get it off the black market. Then we create a black market for the cash derived from marijuana sales. Now, rescheduling the drug could achieve some of that. But this is a much more coherent and detailed approach. It would also deschedule it from the Drug Enforcement Act, as I mentioned. It would exempt any person acting in compliance with state marijuana laws from criminal penalties at the federal level. It would allow those with certain marijuana convictions to expunge them from their records. And the federal government would no longer be able to use marijuana drug tests to block people from states with legal weed from applying for certain federal jobs. So, and the final element here is that it allows healthcare workers to recommend medical marijuana at the Veterans Administration hospitals. So this is intelligent. It is up to date. And, of course, it'll go nowhere in the current climate inside the Beltway. Also, speaking of drugs and regulation, Trump has announced that he's finally found a job for Chris Christie, the governor of New Jersey, who is termed out and tainted by Bridgegate, and there's been a move in that that we'll get to in a moment. Now, I don't like Chris Christie at all. I think he's a real asshole. But when he was running for president last year, the only humanity he showed was in New Hampshire, where he talked compassionately about people who are addicted to OxyContin, other oxycodone and those types of drugs, and some who have moved on to heroin when they can no longer get the prescription drugs. And so we'll see what he does with this. Obviously, he's going to use it as a platform to try to build a national following and erase his ugly political record in New Jersey. But yesterday on Capitol Hill, Senator Claire McCaskill, who I am sometimes critical of, she's a former attorney general or prosecutor from Missouri, and she was grilling officials, I believe, from the Purdue Pharmaceutical Company, although the Associated Press that delivered this article didn't bother to name the company responsible for creating and promoting OxyContin use, with little concern for its addictive qualities. More than 52,000 people died of drug overdoses in 2015, and roughly two-thirds of them had used prescription opioids or heroin. The overdoses have jumped 33% in the past 5 years alone. In some states, the death toll has doubled or even more. And in September, the AP published an investigation outlining how makers of prescription painkillers, like Purdue, which is not named in this article, have adopted a 50-state strategy that includes hundreds of lobbyists and millions in campaign contributions to help kill or weaken measures at stemming the tide of prescription opioids. The industry and its allies spent more than $880 million nationwide in the last 9 years to keep OxyContin flowing freely and addicting more and more people. Also yesterday in Newark, a resolution of Christie's Bridgegate scandal, as one of his top aides, Bridget Kelly, was sentenced to 18 months in state prison, and Bill Baroni got 2 years in state prison for their roles in the 2013 George Washington Bridge lane closing scandal that was payback to the Democratic mayor of Fort Lee, New Jersey. It shows just how petty Chris Christie and his cronies can be. And Rachel Maddow deserves credit for this. She overcovered the Bridgegate scandal until I was ready to puke. But it's fair to say that these convictions and sentences would not be occurring if she hadn't given it the attention she did. And ironically, last night on her program, Rachel had spent so much time in Pravda mode covering Rumptrusha. I'm going to leave that. Yeah, Rumptrusha. That on my recording on the DVR, in the very last seconds of her show when she got to her victory lap about Bridgegate. She ran overtime and was cut off in mid-sentence. The judge in Hawaii, who issued the initial stay on President Trump's travel ban 2.0, the royal decree, has extended his stay. It's not permanent, but he's just extended the time limit, and it will go on for at least 60 days. Now, what is fascinating here is that the Trump administration told us that after the first travel ban issued at the end of January was invalidated, that the courts and a so-called judge had put the nation at risk because there are evil people trying to sneak into our country, trying to commit violence and mayhem. And despite that hysterical and highly exaggerated assessment of the threat level, the administration still has not filed an appeal. They've had a Justice Department lawyer try to narrow the stay that was put on by Judge Derek Watson in Honolulu. He turned him down. But they haven't filed an appeal. And maybe they figure the Ninth Circuit will rule the same way they did last time. But it is bizarre. And we're going to have to see where it all goes. Finally, we're dancing in the streets here in California, dodging the potholes as we do it. I don't know about where you live, but the Golden State's freeways and city streets are in terrible condition. I may have told you when I drove to Los Angeles recently, Interstate 5 was so full of potholes that my car was just bounced all over the place. One of my wheel covers came off. And I'm sure other people sustain even more significant damage to shocks and chassis, not to mention wheels and brakes. In California, because Arnold Schwarzenegger would not raise taxes while he was governor, has allowed these problems to fester. And Jerry Brown bought a little time, too. He should have addressed this earlier, but at least he's doing it now. So he's made a deal with the legislature to increase gasoline taxes and vehicle registration fees to raise about $5 billion a year for 10 years, a $52 billion plan to fill potholes here in California. Hallelujah. Thanks for listening to my news and comment podcast. It's available on YouTube, and I'm Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.